Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are reminding you that if you like this podcast, you can rate this podcast. You can donate to this podcast.
Yes.
I don't have a third thing that rhymes with rate and donate, but we like this podcast.
We
want to keep bringing this to you. Hit us up at faithuncut.com to donate. Check out what we got going on over there. I need to get back to writing.
Yeah, I need to get on some writing.
I'm writing for school now, and I'm also writing something else. But I'm going to try to put some more content up there. But again, if you want to support, we're out there to support. Also support other podcasts, too. You know, we're not just here for
we appreciate it, most definitely.
It's one of those things where, you put out the money because you love to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is encouraging when that money comes back. So,
so
thank you for joining us again for another episode. We are talking the evolution of personal theology this week. And we briefly touched on last week when we were discussing our homecoming and returning to church. And we kind of glossed over this part because we knew we were coming back to do this episode.
Yes.
So
this is our deep dive.
Get ready. All right. So what is theology? All right. So one definition of theology is the study of the nature of God and religious belief. Okay, so theologian Karl Barth describes it as human talk about God. Okay. He says everything that the church says is basically human talk about God. And theology for him is that talk mixed with the action that comes as a result of that talk. So theology actually does something. It's not just sitting around talking about God. The late James Cone, he's the father of liberation theology, basically says any message that is not related to the liberation of the poor in a society is not Christ's message. Any theology that is indifferent to the theme of liberation is not Christian theology.
Ooh.
So from Cone's lens, theology has a focus on liberation.
Okay.
And that is looking at the story of Israel and what Jesus did in terms of his earthly ministry and through his sacrifice, resurrection on the cross. The theme, as Cone sees it, is liberation. Contrast that with Dolores Williams, who is a critic of Cone, not just a critic of Cone, but she has critiqued his work to a degree where it's actually helpful for him. She would say it's not necessarily a focus on liberation. And you can't say that God is primarily concerned with liberation. As an example, she uses Hagar and how when Hagar escaped from Abraham and Sarah, God told her to go back into enslavement. And so theology from what God, how God is involved, is not always about liberation. And so she calls this God talk, and it's an interpretation of the past, present, and historicity of African-American woman and
their relationship to God.
Right. So that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be liberated, but it is a bird's eye view of what that relationship, how that relationship looks and is with God.
Okay.
All right. So those are three of many takes on theology. Well, actually, plus the definition, which is not fair to say the definition like it's the only one.
All right.
Lots of people have different takes on this. People do this for a living.
Yes.
There's theologians all over, and they do not always agree. They may agree with each other, and there may be a little bit different twist on it or a different focus. But theology is one of those things where you'll see it's different for different people.
Of course.
I guess one of the things I want to start with up front is I grew up, I don't know about you, Amir, but in churches where I would hear sermons, they would mention theologians as if they were this other group, like though that's the naughty group over there, like they're not really doing stuff about God, or they're not it's like, you know, they'll say things like the theologians may not agree with me, or I'm no theologian or like, and
I've heard that. But was that just to ostracize the fact that maybe they were saying that the theologians are too rooted in academia or too esoteric in the study of the religion? Because if I'm in the pulpit, and well, not me personally, but what I have heard in that vein is someone trying to separate themselves as if their spiritual awareness of what they're discussing is more sharp than someone who just studied it out of a book.
Yes. So here's what's interesting about that. Like, there's been a historical bias in theology, particularly European theology, against some of the things that you would see going on in a black church.
Yes.
Not just a black church, but maybe a Latino church or Latinx church or a Korean church or things like that. Like anything where there's less of an academic bent and maybe more of an spiritual esoteric bent, then you would see that's kind of othered from theologians. And so that could be an attempt to differentiate and say, listen, we're not like
them,
those stuffy academics. Like you said, we are, you know, we have this other thing too. And that's important to affirm, because as some theologians have made the mistake of denying these other experiences with regard to relationships with God,
denying or dismissing them,
correct,
more so about the culture, considering that Christianity has been used to introduce systems to these people and places. When you think about it, it's not like in those Latin churches or in those, you know, African rooted churches. I don't think that a European centered or Eurocentered theologian is going to understand all the time what they see in those religious practices. And even like now you have a debate about, you know, how Christian of a nation is the United States, but it takes on so many shades when you mix in the culture in which the worship is taking place. So that hasn't really changed. And I think that kind of, I don't want to say negating it or dismissing it, but not holding it in the same esteem as, let's say, certain, you're not holding it in the same esteem. Like these forms of worship are not as formal or not as clear cut as a Eurocentric form of worship. I just think that is, again, an extension of that majority culture trying to make sense of what has been happening in the microcultures that are under it. It's not for you.
Correct. The other side of that coin is,
okay,
while that may be sort of an affirmation that, hey, we're out here too, and we should not be dismissed because we have a different experience, it also creates this anti-intellectualism where it almost suggests that don't be a theologian or don't go this way where there is all, like, you'll be too stuffy up in these universities and you'll miss the good stuff that we have going on here. And I think that's harmful. I think that both sides of that are harmful. I think that, you should not deny these other experiences, and of course, there should be some academic rigor placed on what's understanding what's happening there. But then also, yes, study is important. I think you should study.
Yeah.
And not just, you know, you break out your, you know, whatever your men's study Bible or whatever. Like, I mean, yeah, okay. But there's, if we're really talking about God, there's a lot to learn.
Yes, there is a lot to learn. So and we should way more than one person could probably ever absorb. But it's just like what you're describing, where there might not be an appreciation for the different perspectives that would go into the study of theology or the development of one's personal theology. That is decentering whatever you thought you knew and putting yourself in the middle. So it's kind of the same with any other social science, where even in history, you realize that in an attempt to control what is said about a subject, there was a value placed on certain sources. So, you know, recently working with a friend of mine who's in a master's program for history, we're talking about the fact that most historians would not validate oral histories and would not want to use oral history to inform things that should have documentation. But if you also look at policy-wise, that under colonialism and imperialism, usually a requirement of the native population or the imported population is illiteracy, then they don't get to write down what they know. So if you discredit oral history, then it's like you control the narrative. It's kind of going to be the same thing. So when you say there's harm on both sides, it's finding your way back to the middle where you add value back to where, to how people do things that make sense or work and function within their culture and within their usability, while also saying, here's the systemic study of that thing. So I see the middle ground.
So what we want to do is kind of talk about the existence or the very real concept of a personal theology. And in churches, I guess we look at it as a shared theology, meaning this is what this church believes or this is what this religious body believes. And we kind of all fall in line under that. And it's not so much encouraged or even acknowledged that you could believe differently. You can have a slightly different take on this or vastly different take on this. Maybe you may not be a part of that body, but that shouldn't preclude you from actually understanding God the way you do. When I was training in martial arts, one of my it's basically like a in Filipino martial arts. It's basically your instructor, your master, and we were learning these techniques, and this is a combat art. And so occasionally I would come to him and I would say, well, listen, you know, I see what you're doing here, but why wouldn't you do it this way? Or why wouldn't you strike this way? And he would say, you know what, you can. And as I kept doing that, I would invent different ways of attacking. And one day he came to me and he said, now this the artist Kali, and he came to me, he said, now this is your Kali. And he was letting me know, this is what you do. Like, this is, yeah, I'm showing you the structure.
Right, but you've personalized it.
You create in this. You understand it the way you see, because everyone comes from a different background. Like, he comes from a traditionally Kali background. Maybe there's some Taekwondo there. And I come from a Muay Thai background or some boxing or things like that. So as you start to meld these styles, it becomes your thing. And that's, to me, how I see like theology working, because we all encounter God in different ways. We're all coming from different backgrounds. And as we start to understand and kind of process some of the stuff that we're learning, it's not going to look the same for everyone.
No.
And so it is okay to have this personal theology.
Right.
Everyone has one. And that's why theologians don't always agree on what they're where they're coming from, but they can respect each other and understand that this is their position and maybe this is why it's their position, and that's fine.
So, granted that everybody comes or approaches theology with their different perspectives and that their perspectives are informed by their experiences, it begs the question whether theology can and should change. And the basic answer is yes, in that if theology is the study of God, unless you know everything about God, of course, your theology should grow as your understanding of God grows.
Yeah, that's right. If you're talking or learning about something that is unlearnable in the time that we have,
right,
you would expect that to look different.
I think as you evolve, we've talked about God taking on different roles in your life depending on what's going on in your life, and not our journeys, you know, in and out of service, notwithstanding, even in my own situation, I've seen my theology develop as I've matured into my adulthood. It's way different than what I was being taught as a young, impressionable teenager. Now sitting here, I'm like, certain things work, certain things don't work for me.
Yeah, it's one of those. Okay, so the way I was taught and have come to understand it, theology is a system, and we're saying it's a personal theology, so it is your system. Now you get to this system through a number of ways, which we'll talk about in a minute. But in terms of how that system changes over time, you look at someone like a James Cone, who is the architect from what we acknowledge of liberation theology. His theology changed as he expressed his system. Then people like Dolores Williams will come and critique that system. And so he goes from a theology that's primarily focused on men to including gender and class and things like that. And then so that's how you see his progression of his system, and it's an improvement. You're refining the system. And so, like, if you look at Martin Luther King, who, it's funny, like, his theology was different than most evangelical Christian theology. Like, he didn't acknowledge the virgin birth. He didn't acknowledge Jesus's bodily resurrection. Like, he didn't believe in that. Now because he he went to Boston University, mm-hmm. and they have this theology of personalism. That's what he learned there. And his theology was what led to his nonviolent stance. And then as he grew, he saw differences in, you know, what he was addressing. And so his theology began to include things like class and understanding right. how all of this works together. And this is towards the end of his life. And again, theology is also not necessarily exclusively Christian.
So, no, it's not. Because as you gave that example, I'm thinking about the scenes in the movie Malcolm X,
yeah.
where his theology appears to have evolved after the Hajj, where he was able to challenge certain preconceived notions he had about race
yeah.
after seeing the diversity of Muslims yeah. in worship. So, and I think at least what was depicted is that he came back enlightened and not able to separate that diversity from the vision that he wanted to see more effectively played out, you know, after that Hajj. It was true. It appeared to be, or was depicted as, the life-changing experience that most Muslims hold close to their heart, to be able to make that pilgrimage and to be in worship with so many thousands of people is closely held as something that is, you know, meant to change your perspective.
Yeah, so Malcolm is really interesting. That's a great example mm-hmm. because he was exposed to a theology coming out of prison, or in prison and coming out of prison, when Elijah Muhammad talked to him and basically gave him what they believe in the Nation of Islam, which is not necessarily Islamic theology. Mm-hmm. It's a different theology. We'll talk about, actually, we have an episode coming up, I believe, later this month, where I'm going to talk a little bit more detail about this. But completely different creation mm-hmm. story. In his creation story, in the creation story that the Nation of Islam produces, white people are created by a black scientist as the Satan. And so it leads to why he saw things a certain way. And right. so though that, in addition to everything that went on in his life, kind of shaped his theology to think, let's say that, for instance, mm-hmm. that white people are the devil. Then when he goes on his Hajj, after he's left the Nation of Islam, he goes to Mecca and he sees all of these white people who don't act like white people in America.
Nope.
Like, he sees white people that are acting like his brother, and there's no racial distinction. There's no racism there. And so that it changed him for the rest of his life, which was, you know, by that time, 9 to 11 months left.
Yeah.
But yeah, his theology changed based on what he encountered. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. His theology was formed on what he had encountered, and then it changed based on what he encountered. Yeah, it's everyone does it.
Mm-hmm.
The other example I can think of is the Dalai Lama, where it went from kind of like a personal reflective meditation to an analytic meditation with a call to action.
Mm-hmm.
So the Dalai Lama has progressed in his theology, his Buddhist theology, over the course of his life. And, you know, that's how it should go.
Mm-hmm.
So your personal theology, your personal theological system, once that's defined, should be malleable to your life experiences, because those life experiences are ways that we understand God and how we relate to God's creation. So let's talk about the process.
So first you have to identify what you believe.
Critical. That is critical to, like, this is a step where a lot of people get caught.
I was just about to say, this is a step that's going to wear you out.
Mm-hmm. Especially, like, if you're going to church a lot,
mm-hmm.
And you don't have to apply a lot of critical thought to what's going on.
Exactly.
And you don't do a lot of independent study. You'll get the same, you know, stories over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to shape a theology around that, because you're getting piece. It's like somebody gave you a puzzle,
yep.
and they left out the middle, but you just got the corners.
Right. This is also a space where I think dissonance gets dislodged, because you start to ask yourself what really makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find that maybe a lot of things you've been fed over the years don't jive with you, or don't make sense. You cannot reconcile them. And that's usually what we described with the examples earlier, with Cone, King, Dalai Lama, Malcolm X, is that life experiences continued to inform how they were going to behave within their religious expression, or within their description of religion, and within their description of how theological systems are supposed to operate when humans are involved. So it's going to be the same on a personal level, where people will begin to confront whether or not maybe the sound bites or maybe the policies don't make sense. I know for me, I began to ask, where were the policies rooted? Mm-hmm. You know, if the policies of the organization are rooted in the word, then I'm thinking that certain things should be a certain way. But if they're not, then where are they rooted?
You mean the church
policies? Yeah, within the church. Like, yeah. So, yeah. Who can do what? You know, what are the processes for dealing with conflict within family or within different groups? And usually there's some sort of, every organization has policies and procedures. So I began to ask certain questions. I wasn't satisfied with those answers. And it wasn't about disobedience. It was about actually wanting to think critically about, you know, why do we say what we say? Why do we do what we do? So that helped inform for me an evolution in that space. Hmm.
Identifying what you believe, it can be, as you're describing, which is kind of one of the ways that it happened for me, where I'm starting to see what's going on and I'm like, this doesn't, mm-hmm. I don't know about this. This, or you could also go with an academic format, mm-hmm. where you can just sit down and say, what is my anthropology, or how do I view humanity? Mm-hmm. How do I view, what is my theodicy, or how do I view God's justice, or my soteriology? How do I view salvation? What is that? Mm-hmm. You know, what is my eschatology?
See, I didn't have that academic background.
So you don't have to have it. You don't have to use that, but you still, like, what is my Christology? Like, what do I believe about Jesus?
Exactly. So what I'm saying is, in getting to that, it was more so choosing an affirmative statement about me that then helped guide the piece, you know, adding back the pieces. So in a certain state, in a certain process in my life, I said, you know what I believe? I believe that God loves me just as I am, mm-hmm. with all of my mess, like all of it. And when I thought of what all of that mess was, I could see where, you know, maybe there was an outspoken portion of what I've been learning over time that said, you know, God absolutely hates this. For instance, God hates divorce. Okay, well, I'm divorced, but I believe that God loves me, mm-hmm. and wants what's best for me. Then I started to fill in and take away things that disrupted that idea. Because ultimately, that's the bottom line for me. I might have considered those questions, but I wouldn't have known the academic names for those things.
And the academic names are not important. What's important is, what do you see about what do you understand about these things? Like, what do you think about God's view of justice? Like, you got, mm-hmm. divorced. What does that mean? Are we going to proof text and say, you know, someone's going to come up and say, God hates divorce, and then what does that mean for you? Or, mm-hmm. Or you may look at that and say, well, what about this situation where they're permitting divorce? Or, like, mm-hmm. so, like,
that's exactly what happened.
Understanding. Yeah, I know. That's what happened to me, too. Mm-hmm. That's what church people do. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it comes from a lack of understanding. Remember, you're only getting a very narrow portion of the scriptures in church. Right. So this is one of the reasons why the church goes up when you quote a scripture. Because we all know the scripture, because it's been, there's some rote memory there. We've been hearing it over and over again. Never mind this whole body of scriptures that we just don't even touch.
Right.
So, yeah, that's you get that because that's what we've been trained to do. So once you start to identify what you believe, then you have to actually assess if that thing is worth believing. And those are the challenges that we're talking about, mm-hmm. In terms of, okay, when life hits you, like,
yeah.
I'm getting divorced, you know, I've lost a child, I've lost a parent, mm-hmm. you know, those type of things. It's not just loss. It's also maybe challenges from someone else with a different theological view. Or mm-hmm. Like, say, so you're at the barbershop and, you know, somebody from the nation comes in there and then you're having a conversation about that. Or somebody, mm-hmm. who doesn't believe in God is waiting for their chair, mm-hmm. and you're talking about that. Or, you know, you could be anywhere having these type of conversations, but something is going to challenge what it is that you believe. That's why the first step of knowing what you believe is important, because it'll rock you if you don't even have an idea. That's what happened to me when I was in college, when I got invited to that Bible study that ended up being a cult, and I couldn't articulate why this is not right. I just knew it wasn't right.
Right, but it didn't feel right.
Right, but I didn't have the language to say, okay, not necessarily to discount what they were saying, mm-hmm. even though it was worth discounting, but to affirm what I believe. I didn't have that.
Right.
So you'll get these inklings of things that maybe that may not line up in the scriptures. Like you'll say, you know, this scripture says one thing over here, but then this thing says the other thing. Mm-hmm. Or let's say with the way that Christians use homosexuality bashing scriptures.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking this. Mm-hmm.
Like you're saying, okay, this is what you're saying, but then I'm looking at, let's say, the law in Leviticus, and you're not adhering to all this other stuff. So how do I make this work?
Right.
You know. Okay. So you're saying that the devil was kicked out of heaven, and now I'm looking at Job, and I see, you know, he waltzes into heaven, and basically makes a bet with God. Is gambling wrong? Why is the devil in heaven? You know, it's like stuff like that. Once you start to ask these questions, then you're starting to get open to, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's something here worth investigating or worth studying.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also trust your instinct, that God in you, because something will stand out if it doesn't feel right. Yep. Even if you can't, like I said, I couldn't articulate it, but I knew something wasn't right there when I got invited to the cult. Go with that. Like, you have to know that that's the way I see it, is God is with all of us, and and kind of guiding what it is that, like, this is the right choice or this is not the right choice. This choice is not going to be, this choice may be good for you, but it's going to harm all those people. So that's not the right thing to do. This, like, there's always, and people call it different things. People may call it, you know, conviction or the Holy Spirit. They may call it, you know, different thing. They may call it intuition. They, whatever. Whatever you call it, something lets you know.
Right. This might not be for me.
Right. So that's when you start to assess what it is, if what you believe is actually worth believing.
Right. And along with that, you have to stop believing things that you have come to the conclusion are not worth believing. And sometimes this is about a reestablishment of esteem and affirming good things, because sometimes the theologies that we've grown up on or that have been presented to us involve almost like stepping on one aspect of humanity to venerate the other, or making it seem like there's going to always be a winner and a loser about questions that clearly should have no winner and no loser. It might also be about, you know, for women, I think this is very important, because we're still fighting against systems that do not affirm and value women's presence, their contribution, and their worth beyond their functionality. And what you will find is that in developing, taking the time to develop your theology and say, why do I believe what I believe? You know, I've brought this up before. If a woman is a single parent and she is not that married woman sitting in the church, she might want a marriage, but I think it is harmful to her to think that the condition of marriage just makes you better.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a well-rounded thought, and I'm speaking from both sides of it. And we've talked about how pursuing status without understanding why you're pursuing that status and having that cloaked in some sort of, you know, either spiritual pursuit or, you know, dressed up with a bunch of scriptures or whatever, that can be harmful to you, because what if you don't get it? What if that's not you? You should be able to be affirmed right where you are.
So when you're trying to stop believing things that you identified are not worth believing, that is terrifying.
Yeah.
I remember the first time when it occurred to me, like, wait a minute. Hell is not a real thing, or the scriptures, hell is not a real, like, this is not, why are we doing it, like, what? And I was like, oh, you can't say that. You can't. Who do I tell? It's this big, so it's this big,
this
liberating
with?
feeling, like, oh my God, this is, yo, this is great. Nobody wants to hear this, and it's so isolating, because you're doing work that not everyone is doing.
Yeah, that's true.
And you may be at a point of discovering something that you still need to go further in terms of understanding. Maybe you validated that conclusion is probably dead on. But, you know, am I going to get into a debate about this with the whole world of Christianity or Islam or whatever?
Faith?
Like, am I ready to go against that?
Right.
So it's scary. But the encouraging thing that I found was, like, that's not the first time anyone's had that thought.
No, and it won't be the last, because it kind of goes back to this idea of incompletion. Because this is an ongoing discovery, mm-hmm. I don't think that it's meant to ever be finalized, because that's the joy of the mystery of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. If you have an inquisitive mind, here's a rabbit hole that kind of never ends, mm-hmm. because the human condition will constantly produce facets against which you can kind of do these comparisons. You can say, does God really have space and capacity for, you know, a person who lives their life this way, or a person who thinks of themselves in a certain way? And when you center, especially if that's happening to you, if you center yourself, you'll be amazed at what all God still does for you, even though you're not maybe following the published line of how to be the best Christian, or, you know, here's the do's and don'ts of this lifestyle. A lot of things started making sense when I threw out these preconceived notions and just said, I want to experience something intimate, and opening up for the intimacy of it just means, you know, that's when you're pulling something in so close to you and just saying, this is kind of who I am, this is where I am with this, and let's see if we can figure this thing out. And what you'll find is a lot of the handcuffs, a lot of the caging is man-made.
That's what's amazing about it, because it's not until you get into actually assessing what it is that you believe, why you believe it, and if it's not worth believing, letting it go, that you start to liberate yourself from some of these things that were harmful to you that you just didn't know. I mean, you just thought it was normal. It's just like having a toothache and you just don't have money to go to the dentist, so you just deal with it for months or whatever, and then once you get it fixed, you're like, oh my God, you know,
I should have did this sooner.
Well, first time you get glasses, which was amazing to me, like the first time you get glasses when you didn't know you couldn't see, and then you put the glasses on, you like, this is, it's a whole world.
That's
out
probably
here.
How I'm gonna feel, because I can't see.
You should do it. I'm telling you that I wish I could have that one moment over again.
Really? Exhilaration.
It's just like everything is in color.
Healing.
Okay. So anyway, that's kind of what it's like. Like, it's worth doing.
Yep.
It's scary, and you'll have these thoughts, and then, you know, people have written books about that thought. Yep. That one thought. And
it's life changing. Yeah. I mean, when you think about how much goes into training up a child in the way that he should go. Okay. Like, some people take that thing so literal and so serious that to be that child and enter into your own questioning process and your own unlearning and learning new things, that seems like it would produce, you know, so much material on just the, I keep saying, the mystery. I always think about the mystery of God, because I don't want to figure him all the way out. I don't want to. I will lose interest in something that I figured completely out. Just how my personality is. So I like things that constantly be like, well, what about this? Mm-hmm. Well, what about that? But developing my personal theology over, let's say, 20 years has allowed me to love better. I live a better life. I live a more full life. I love me better because I understand that that's what I believe about God, that he loves me the best. It's taken a long time to get to that place and to believe it, because him loving me in the condition that I had, you know, seen myself in, meant that that was probably a greater, more truer, more covering love than I had experienced. So if he's capable of that, which is what I said that I believe, that's why I said I started from that place and started to add things back. It has helped me love people as I'm experiencing them. You know what? I don't even require that you change. And if I require that you change, that's not love, and I'm going to take a step back.
Right. And that's
freedom.
Yeah, that's so different than what you're going. I attended an evangelism situation.
Okay.
And I knew going in, I was like, I didn't want to be here. I don't want to do this. This doesn't make sense. What you're trying to do. This looks like something else that was happening in this country a few hundred years ago. I don't like this.
Don't like it.
But the good thing is I was able to endure that. And not be affected by it like I normally would have, like, years ago, because my theology was intact by this time. And I'm like, yeah, what you're saying, I vehemently disagree with.
And I'm good with it.
Yeah. Are you going to do something good with this? And that's my question. So we went through kind of high level 4-step process for this, is identifying what you believe, assessing if it's worth believing, stop or ceasing to believe those things that are not worth believing, mm-hmm. and then learning what is worth believing. Mm-hmm. That is the process after that. Like, yeah. the process of learning is where you really start to stretch your wings and go. Mm-hmm. But as you're starting to do this, you want to make sure you do this in a healthy and ethical way, because at this point you are now creating something.
Yep. Like that someone else might be able to tap into.
Right. You're not bringing forward, you know, hundreds of years of SDA doctrine or, you know, Episcopalian doctrine or Catholic doctrine. Like, you are forming something. Right. And this is a powerful tool.
This is
tool.
The customization of your jacket.
Yeah.
You have a jacket. Now you're putting stuff on your jacket. You're customizing your jacket.
This is the airbrushing of your faith. The bedazzling of your rhinestones.
The bedazzling of your situation.
So for me, it looked like I had to understand what made my theology healthy. And my first top priority was, does not harm me, mm-hmm. does not harm anyone else. Because I was operating under the idea that based on what I've seen, based on what I've read and experienced, if your God hurts people, then you hurt people.
This is true.
Because who wouldn't want to be like their God, like you, especially in a God that you believe is telling you to be like him, be holy, right. and righteous, and be like me, and right. do all these things like me. And then you also have to deal with the vengeance and the justice and all these other elements.
The only thing about that is, I believe that, again, the relationship between God and man is that they are reflective of one another. Man is going to learn more about himself as he sees himself the way God sees him, or as he considers, how does God see me? And I think that even though you want a personal theology that first seeks to do no harm, basically, it's a part of human nature to hurt and be hurt and hurt other people. You see what I'm saying? So there has to, I just feel like that piece is something that is going to be subjective. Maybe subjective isn't the right word, but I just feel like that part of it doesn't harm me, and I don't harm anybody else, because if my God harms people, then I will harm people. People harm people.
Yeah. And that's just, and I wasn't going to go into any personal theology today. I mean, about mine, but just, without going into it, I'm slightly process in terms of my theology. It's okay. Process theology, and one of those elements is that God is a part of everyone, mm-hmm. and it doesn't make sense that the God in me would harm the God in you. The God in me would direct me, hey, that's a mirror, like watch out for her. Because
okay.
that's me. Or take care of her, or, you know, make sure you just don't do any damage to her. This move that you're going to make a lot of money on is still going to hurt me.
Right.
So let's do something else. Let's do something better.
Let's think about something.
And so,
okay, I can understand that.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I operate, because, and it's the principle, like, you know, where, you know, my children are part of me, mm-hmm. no matter what. Whether they're my biological children or not, because they're in this house in proximity to me, I'm raising them, they're going to carry part of me. Mm-hmm. And that part of me is going to always be with them, no matter where I am. I got a son and a daughter. You harming each other, you're harming the same thing that you are. Like, don't do that to each other. Take care of each other. Like,
and you hope that shines through. I think that if that is the value, if that is the ideal, then I can see that being a compass point, something that keeps you straight, because that's the first thing you're thinking, mm-hmm. that the God in me doesn't want to harm you, mm-hmm. because I recognize the God in you. Mm-hmm. And that I think that's worth focusing on, even though I think human nature says we're gonna sometimes get that piece wrong. People
yes.
fight.
Yes. So you have a choice in what you do.
That pesky free will.
Lord, so we really getting into it. All right. So think about it like this. Like, my analogy for this is, mm-hmm. everything that we do, I look at it as I'm a musician. So everything that we do is a note on let's say a note on a keyboard. Now, let's say the note, the C is a perfectly fine note, mm-hmm. but it's not fine all the time. And that's how everything that we do is structured. Your ability to love people mm-hmm. and always want to be compassionate and everything, and it seems like a good note to play. Mm-hmm. When the person breaks in your house and wants to kill you and your family, that is not the note to play.
Right. Okay?
So there is no note that is going to be the same in every case.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be right in every case. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be wrong in every case.
Right.
I see that freedom to play those notes, that's on us. That's mm-hmm. now, in terms of which notes to play, that's God. Like, that's God directs. God is the music. No, mm-hmm. the music.
Oh.
So the sheet music that says this is the note to play when this is the right note. And that's what I'm talking about, that intuition, that internal thing that says, hey, this is the right thing to do.
Okay.
We get to choose if we're going to play that note. I look at Jesus as the person who shows us how to play the notes the best.
Mm.
Not the best. He shows us how to play the notes. There's other people that shows us how to play the notes.
That's true.
But Jesus was a great example of what to do in terms of how he lived his life, what his ministry was like. And so all of that works together to help us play the notes. But it's more like a symphony. It's we play the notes for and with each other so that we can hopefully play the right notes mm-hmm. at the right times. And there's enough of us where we create this beautiful tapestry. Now, the thing about it is, and this is really going deep into the analogy, I'm really committing to this thing now. So,
but I'm learning.
With any, like, say, orchestra,
mm-hmm.
you practice mm-hmm. together.
Mm-hmm.
You get some notes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're doing now. We're living this life. We're getting some notes right. We're getting them wrong. We're trying to perfect it. Because the goal is to play the notes so that when we hit the stage, we got this right. Okay? So right now, we're working this out. I look at the stage as on the other side of this life. Like, after this, that's where we hit the stage. That's where we play the notes. But we don't wait until we hit the stage to get it right. Right. Nobody ever,
because we've been practicing.
Yeah, no one ever says we haven't played this music right one time, let's go perform.
Exactly.
So in this life, we need to work towards getting this right. And so that's kind of how my system works.
Mm-hmm.
And so me playing the notes, like you and I in the same section, if I'm off on my notes, it affects us.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm right on my notes, it's beautiful.
Right.
It helps us. We are crushing it as a section. We're ready. And then we're helping the orchestra.
Exactly.
And eventually that music, when it's played together, it moves. And there's a lot of ways that I go with this. And, mm-hmm. and
well, that makes sense to me.
But that's like my system. That's not the only system.
No.
There's plenty of
But that's why I said it's a compass point. Because even if you're off that path, the ideal that I don't want to harm myself and I don't want to harm you is a place to get back to. Even if you find that that is not where you are, you're in conflict at the time. So you're saying that it's practice makes perfect and it's the creation of this beautiful music. I'm saying it's like the North Star. So if I ever find myself off of that path and I'm in conflict either with myself or with others, this idea that I do not believe in a being that wants to harm me, nor wants to see me harm you, is a comp. It helps me get back there,
mm-hmm.
even if that's not where I am. So we're saying the same thing, slightly different ways.
And I'm fine with that.
Yeah, but I understand it.
So what I do is, like, because my system works that way, like, I don't go and try to force this on anyone else. I know everyone doesn't see it this way, and that's okay with me, because I'm still going to play my notes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm still going to do what I need to do. And I'm going to listen to that God is not going to harm me. It doesn't matter what my system is, because I'm still not going to harm you. And I'm still not going to harm them. And I'm trying to make sure that we're all doing this as well as we can together. And that is the key for whatever your system is. What does it do in practice? Your theology is not something that you sit in and we just talk eloquently about and say, this is my system. Well, this is my system.
Right.
Like, who cares? No one cares. Martin Luther King didn't tell us what his system was. All he did was get out and it shaped who he was,
yeah.
and then he was able to do something with it. And that is the point of theology. That's why everyone should be doing this. Because, like Bart says, like, yeah, it's talk about God, but there's something that happens as a result of this.
Yes.
And if that something doesn't happen, then you've done nothing. You've wasted everyone's time. I think the quote from the Dalai Lama was, vague talk of peace will only disturb some pigeons. It's worth nothing. Like, right. So you have to get out and do the work. And so here's the thing about the theology. I didn't realize we were going so long, but it's okay to, one, have a personal theology.
Okay.
And two, let that theology adapt and grow.
Yeah.
It should.
It should.
But most importantly, you got to put your theology to work.
Ah.
So that's what we kind of wanted to encourage everyone to do. It does. I mean, your theology, it should be yours. It doesn't have to be everyone's.
Mm-hmm.
But it should help. You should be able to work with this theology.
Exactly.
So however you do this, we hope that you do it. We hope that it's, I'm telling you, it's an exercise worth taking.
Right. Just assessing where you stand with it.
The creation, the evolution of your personal theology is one of the best things that you will ever do. It's mm-hmm. not anything to be afraid of. It's not anything to be held as something that happens off there in seminaries. It's not anything that should be othering anyone else. It is something that is fulfilling to you
mm-hmm.
and hopefully to someone else. So that's it.
Okay, that's it.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.